Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Young, it's Here and Now. The U.S. military said today that U.S. troops shot and killed two Iraqi women in a speeding car that failed to stop at a checkpoint north of Baghdad today. The Iraqi police said that one of the women was pregnant and she was rushing to the maternity ward with her cousin when they were both killed. This, what seems like a tragic mistake, comes as the U.S. military investigates allegations of a massacre months ago. In a moment, we're going to hear an interview with a soldier who was in Haditha on November 19, 2005. We'll also hear from Senator Ted Kennedy, who says it's time to bring the troops home. But first, joining us on the line from Washington is Michael Weisskopf. He's a senior correspondent for Time magazine, which broke the Haditha story back in March. And Michael, could you first of all remind us, I mean, there are so many leaks and rumors now. We understand that what is known is that an explosive device went off in Haditha, killing one Marine in a convoy.
Yes, and the story varies considerably. Marines who were on the scene and have talked to investigators are said to claim that the roadside bomb itself killed 15 civilians and that they killed another 9 in a hostile fire.
Yeah. Well, and this
24 and you know, the reports from a human rights group based on sort of eyewitness accounts differs from that.
Well, and this week, Lance Corporal from that Marine unit also spoke out publicly. What he said was very graphic, we should say, but Ryan Briones told the Los Angeles Times that he was ordered to take pictures of the dead Iraqis, and he says women and children were among the victims. He says he picked up the body of a little girl. Her brains fell out onto his boots. Do we know, first of all, where these photos are? Does the military have them?
The military is supposed to have some photos. It's not clear exactly what they have. It's also, you know, I got the sense from the interview you just referred to, he himself had photos, the Lance Corporal, and that some of them may have been downloaded off of his camera before he took back the camera and then erased the photos, but that they may have been downloaded.
Well,
not clear.
Today, another Marine is speaking out. Lance Corporal James Crossan was nearly killed in that roadside bombing, the one that started the whole incident. Yesterday, he told a King TV reporter in Seattle that the Marines, his fellow Marines, might have snapped after the explosion. We want to just take 2 minutes. Let's listen to an extended part of that interview.
I think they were just blinded by hate when they see TJ blown to pieces and me freaking stuck underneath the rear wheel, not knowing what happened. And they just lost control. Bad things happen. And since being so far away, being so hot, and all that stuff, you just lose control, sort of. Just kind of stop caring what happens. And I guess I'm pretty sure that's what happened over there. You just can't tell who the bad guy was, and probably half of them were bad guys, and you just never know. I know in my heart, if I was there, I possibly could have stopped what happened, because I know that the other team leaders and even Staff Sergeant now, they all kind of listened to me and things just went smoother. I feel there probably are other incidents that have happened. They've just been covered up and deemed something else, but who knows? We're supposed to be over there helping the people out, but we go ahead and murder I don't know how many people. I can see that our reputation is on the line over there. We're going to lose our support over there. I believe we've already lost a lot of our support over there, so.
Some people who see this might be horrified that you seem so calm. Can you explain a little bit more why this doesn't seem as shocking or jarring to you as other people might find it? Or maybe it does and you're just not showing us that side. I don't know. Are you horrified by this?
Oh, no. I've seen all kinds of death. I've been to Fallujah the second time. We took the city, and I've seen a whole bunch of death before and destruction. And pretty much my medication, I'm just kind of calm right now.
That's Lance Corporal James Crossan again talking to King TV and Michael Weisskopf, Time magazine. We hasten to say he doesn't say he saw any killing. He was injured in the explosion. And there are two investigations ongoing, and they started, I guess, when Time reporters brought all of this to the attention of military officials in Baghdad.
Yes, in January, we got hold of a videotape that was done by an Iraqi journalism student taken of the aftermath in Haditha, and we reviewed it and brought it to a Marine spokesman in Baghdad, who sort of dismissed it, and from there did a little poking around ourselves, and then brought some information to somebody a little higher up, and that prompted a more widespread investigation.
And what are the status? Because there's two investigations now. Would you explain, you know, why there's more than one, and what's their status?
There's one Marine investigation going on, and there's one Marine criminal investigation going on, and I think the status of both of them is just pending.
Yeah, and one is into allegations of a possible cover-up. Why, you know, what is the indication of that?
The accident reports or after accident reports were pretty whitewashed, it seems. They talked about, as I described, 24 people being killed in what can be described as kind of collateral damage or in fighting. And there were the only photos that were turned in at the time were photos that showed no bodies. And apparently there were photos, as you mentioned earlier, that were taken at the same time, which either were not turned off or they were just sort of photos that were left. They were done individually by soldiers. Anyway, they tell a different story. The question is why was the initial report sanitized? The New York Times reported today that some of the bodies recovered had gunshot wounds in them, some of the civilians, that is, and if they had been killed in a roadside bomb, of course, they wouldn't have had gunshot wounds.
Michael Weitzkopf, senior correspondent for Time magazine. Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
We turn now to Khalif Sepp, retired Army Special Forces officer and counterinsurgency expert. He now teaches at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and he's making one of many visits to here and now. Khalif, we appreciate it. Khalif, what do you make about, you know, all of this?
Well, this kind of atrocity, alleged atrocity, but I think we're at the point where the investigation's going to make charges of murder of noncombatants shortly, is not unique to this kind of war, just counterinsurgency war. It should be remembered that, you know, for example, General George Patton was denied his fourth star for years during the Second World War because he covered up two massacres of German prisoners on the island of Sicily. Was discovered in that. But in counterinsurgency, this kind of fighting is especially difficult. The first duty of a government, whether it's in a war or not, is protection of the lives and property of its citizens. But this is made incredibly difficult in Iraq, where the enemy doesn't wear a uniform or any kind of insignia.
And a soldier is in combat. That's his duty, is to fight. And I'm just wondering, you know, you've spoken to us about this before. You've made an analogy to police. Is the problem that these are soldiers who are trained for combat and not trained for occupations, and they've got this mixed message? They're hunting insurgents while also reconstructing and making friends.
Well, Robin, that's exactly right, and the training of both the American Marines and the American Army ground forces for decades was focused on high intensity warfare, you know, in anticipation of a World War III in Central Europe against the Soviet and Warsaw Pact armies, and other uniformed, you know, regular formations of troops. And even though that there's been, over the last decade after the end of the Cold War, there was much internal discussion inside the military about reorienting itself toward the new duties that would be expected of us of it, like in Haiti, like in Somalia, like in the Balkans, that transition has actually been very, very slow in coming.
Yeah, and when you say transition, also you've said literally that it should be police who are policing these streets. And not soldiers, but who would they be? I mean, given that the Iraqi police have been slow to train.
once again, you've hit on one of the key issues of the insurgency, is that the initially after our occupation, our focus was overwhelmingly on the military. The American military's focus was overwhelmingly on training Iraqi military forces for external defense of the country. The initial military, American military leaders ignored the growing insurgency, what they referred to as internal war, and said that was going to be handled by police. But there has been a series of superb articles by Michael Moss in the New York Times about why the effort for the first 3 years of this conflict, the effort to train the Iraqi police has gone so very badly and is now just now being brought back on track.
Yeah. In fact, we're going to be speaking very soon to Jerry Burke, who is one of the Massachusetts state policemen who was in Iraq recently training the police forces there. But President Bush is speaking today. He's saying he's troubled by the leaked reports of U.S. Marines killing Iraqi civilians. He says if laws were broken, there will be punishment. He also praised the culture of the Marines. My dad was a Marine. Is there something unique to the culture that makes them uniquely wrong for this kind of assignment?
It shouldn't be, because the Marines take great pride in their own traditions of police-like activities, especially in the 1920s and 30s in the Caribbean, in Nicaragua, in the initial occupation of Haiti. But they have been very much shaped by their World War II experience and this direct kind of combat.
Yeah. Khalif Sepp, retired Army Special Forces officer, counterinsurgency expert. He now teaches at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, talking about leaked reports and what he says is an inevitable report of an investigation into a possible massacre at Haditha. Khalif, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy has made a visit to our studios here in Boston to talk about many other things. But, Senator, we, of course, want to get your thoughts first on the Haditha investigation.
I think what you're beginning to see is that this is a military that's stretched out, and that they are constantly under the gun in terms of these IEDs, and they're constantly there's an enormous amount of stress and tension that's put on what is generally considered to be the best trained, best led military units in the world. So we'll have to get to the bottom of, one, what really happened at the incident, and secondly, whether there's a cover-up in terms of the military trying to, if they found that to be true, whether they tried to cover that up. And thirdly, I think we ought to look at the basic policy issues to see if this kind of continued pressure and stress and tension is going to be a continuum in Iraq. I think that this is what we're going to see tragically more of, because I think the military is overstretched. I think it's time that the military come home.
Senator Ted Kennedy, when we come back, we'll address that question. Bring troops home or send in more to strengthen forces? That's what General Casey announced he'll be doing this week. Also, we want to ask you, wither the Democratic Party? You know, when Americans seem so disillusioned with the current White House, why do Democrats seem so ineffective? All of this when we come back here and now. And we're back with more from Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy. He's, by the way, author of two new books. One's a children's book featuring his beloved Portuguese water dog, Splash. It's called My Senator and Me, A Dog's Eye View of Washington, D.C. We'll talk about Splash. But the other book, a more serious offering, The Senator's Prescription to Fix What He Says Is Ailing the Country. It's called America Back on Track. And, Senator, I want to return to a topic you address in the book, Iraq, and also Haditha. You're saying the troops are overstretched, and you're echoing what I heard on conservative radio last night, that the Marines shouldn't be there, bring them home. Are you saying bring them home immediately?
As of January last year, I said that. I think that, number one, we have been in Iraq longer than we were battled in the Korean War. And at the end of this year, we will have been battling longer in Iraq than the whole of Second World War. Mm-hmm. And if we were able to get a military resolution in the Second World War, and we still can't get it in Iraq, it's a clear indication that the military have done what they have had to do. This is not a military solution; it's a political solution, and our military there are helping to inflame the insurgency, and they're a crutch to the various political units and factions that are there that refuse to work through a compromise, and this has deteriorated into a civil war, and these servicemen, military are caught in the middle of this, and it's a tragedy of just enormous proportions. We're not enhancing our security in that region with this continued misguided policy.
How does that square with other members of your party? I'm thinking of Senator Clinton, who say, you know, we broke it, we need to fix it. News yesterday, General Casey sending 1,500 more troops from Kuwait into western Iraq to stabilize that area. It seems as if, you know, members of your party are thinking in the other direction.
Well,
we need to add more troops to fix it.
I wasn't in the majority of my party when I voted against going to war, which was the best vote I've cast in the United States Senate. But beyond that, I think that there's a general sense throughout the Democratic Party that this is the year of transition, that we have to draw down American forces. I would do it more rapidly than probably other members. I agree with Congressman Murther. The United States military in Iraq are part of this whole kind of a problem, and we have to have an entirely new direction in that policy.
I want to ask who's going to lead that. Questions about your party. With few exceptions, it seems, I mean, there's a perception that the debate seems to be going on within the Republican Party, with the Democrats in many cases, except for a few voices, Congressman Murtha, yours come to mind, the Democrats standing on the sideline. That's the perception. We heard that it's part of the party plan, the Democratic Party plan, to stand back and let the Republicans fight among themselves, which they seem to be doing increasingly. But then others, you know, ask, isn't that dangerous? Doesn't that send the signal that the Democrats, you know, have no plan, have no leader?
There are those that strongly oppose the administration's policy, but also are very, very concerned about what the future would bring. But when we wrote in the permission, constitutionally, the permission of the factions to have private militias, for me, that, I mean, I was troubled before, but that was really a death knell.
I guess that's part of what I'm saying. You saw this and were powerless to stop it. And I'm wondering, I mean, some people are asking, why is the Democratic Party so powerless? What do you say?
Well, you have to have a majority to have a hearing. Let me just give you now your example. Do you know how many subpoenas the Republicans used on the Clinton administration?
Oh, gosh.
1,100.
Yeah.
And you know how many subpoenas they have had in terms of oversight on the Iraqi war? 3. You have a responsibility to have an oversight if you are in the majority. But we don't. I can't hold a hearing. I can't. I'm on the Armed Services Committee, and I can't. I can attend it. I can get John Warner to hold hearings on Abu Ghraib, which he did. And I can. The Democrats can get them to do reports on it, which they did. They did 10 studies about Abu Ghraib, and we still haven't gone to the bottom of it.
What do Democrats have to do to become relevant? Some would say, precisely because of what you're saying, the party has become irrelevant.
Well, I would hope that that's an easy cliche. I mean, the Democrats are the ones that, first of all, took on the whole civil rights issues.
But we're talking about
now. Well, we have to look at where you stand if you're going to look at the future, don't we? I mean, doesn't that have some relevancy in terms of what you believe? I certainly do that when I look at an individual, whether I'm going to support them, to look where they stand. Where have they stood? What have they been for? Mm-hmm. And it has been the fact that we did, you know, pass the Medicare. We did pass Medicaid. We did pass education. We took on civil rights issues, all which are very unpopular. And you want to know something? The Democrats have paid a fearsome political price for it, because effectively you've lost the political South and all the rest. But they were prepared to do it. So it isn't as easy as someone who's been in there with Democrats and Republicans alike to just say, oh well, I mean, why isn't there a magic wand that the Democrats have that are going to solve all of these problems? I know what we're fighting for in the party. I know what we tried to do in terms of stopping the privatization of Social Security. I know what we tried to do in terms of the prescription drug bill that was hijacked by the special interests. I know what we've tried to do on immigration, where the Democrats, along with an important group of Republicans, have been trying to reform that kind of a system. And I know the fight that we have made on the Supreme Court justices, which you're just beginning to see with the decision that was made in these last few days, the beginning of the closing down on whistleblowers by Justice Alito and the small band of brothers that were out there trying to protect the whistleblowers and privacy and civil liberties and civil rights. Now, I don't know, if you don't have a majority on these kinds of things, it is very difficult.
Well, look at the time, and we haven't even gotten to Splash. So let's take a second on Splash. What a busy dog. Passing legislation, greeting admirers, keeping his senator fit while playing catch. What's the saying about a man and a dog in Washington?
Well, if you want a friend, you have to get a dog. But I'm fortunate I've got good friends, but I've got a wonderful dog with Splash.
Senator Kennedy, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Senator Ted Kennedy's new children's book about his dog Splash is called My Senator and Me, A Dog's Eye View of Washington, D.C. He also has a new book for their parents. It's called America Back on Track. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. Here and Now.
Open wide. Just breathe through your nose, please.
It's been 25 years since health officials received the first reports of mysterious ailments affecting homosexual men. We now know these were precursors to AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. The death toll since then has been astronomical. 25 million people have died from AIDS. More than 65 million people are said to be infected with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. People are still dying around the world. But after retroviral drugs were improved in the 90s, the survival rate in the U.S. improved as well. And typical patients are living long after they're diagnosed, so long as they take their medication and regularly see their doctor.
I'm just going to take a listen to your heart.
Here and Now's Deborah Becker visited the Fenway Community Health Center in Boston as physician assistant Jerry Foyer, who's been dealing with AIDS since before it had a name, was examining patient Jerry Thorne.
I'm gonna recheck your kidney function again, as we have in the past.
Yes. I'm Jerry Thorne, and I'm 64. I'll be 65 in September. And approximately 10 years ago, I was had a consistent cough, right? And we chatted, and he asked if I had ever had an HIV test. And so we talked, and I decided to be tested. And it turned out at the time that I actually wasn't just HIV positive. I was diagnosed with AIDS. Now, I've been living with this for over 10 years now. I've never had any opportunistic infection other than that cough in the beginning. I've been doing fine. The biggest deal for me doing so well, I believe, is I try to do exactly what my primary care physician and other doctors suggest I do. I have a 90-year-old mother who loves me, two grown daughters and two granddaughters, and a host of real, real caring friends.
Do you know how you got the disease?
I have no idea. No, it's never been determined.
Your treatment before consisted of what, and how has that changed?
I was taking up to 13 different pills a day, and now I'm only taking two pills a day.
So do you think that you're a success story?
I don't know that I call myself a success. I'm lucky to be alive. I'm lucky to be here to enjoy my grandchildren, which I certainly do.
Well, you look great. You feel good?
Yes, I definitely. Except I don't have the energy I used to, and he tells me, well, we're not getting any younger.
I'm Jerry Foyer. I'm a physician assistant at Fenway Community Health Center. This man is doing exceptionally well and has been for many, many years.
And is that common? Is he a common patient, would you say?
I'd say he's common for one of my patients. I think that there are populations of folks who are less compliant in terms of their ability to take their medications.
So now that you have basically, I'm assuming that's the most common form of treating AIDS, this drug regimen, I imagine it's good, but does it also inspire maybe a certain degree of complacency about the virus itself? Well, if I catch it, I'll be able to treat it successfully, probably, so I maybe don't have to be as safe as I thought I did.
We do see some of that. We see people using illicit drugs and putting themselves at tremendous risk. We now have a tremendous handle on this disease. Would I wish this on anybody? If I had a choice, no. There are many, many complications to medications. Not everybody responds to medications. It's a lifelong course of medication. We have not been able to cure this disease.
And can you describe for me how treatment has changed and what it was like when you first started treating people with HIV and AIDS?
Well, remember, 1981 was a blip. It was a blip on a screen. Nobody knew what it meant that we had these cases out in Los Angeles. By the end of 1981, there were nearly 1,000 cases identified throughout the country. You know, we started having the trickling in of people coming in with swollen glands, fevers, night sweats. It was a time when we didn't know anything about what even caused this. HIV, the virus, was not identified until 1983. It was a time of great fear. People were coming in here very, very upset, not knowing what their future held. Patients relied on us to just listen. You know, my social work hat, my psychologist hat, had to be put on quite a bit in those days because we had nothing to offer people. We later learned that 3 drugs were necessary to suppress this virus, and that didn't happen until 1995. And the epidemic has been very, very different in the last 10 years. That's very different than the 1980s and 90s, early 90s, when we had 1 or 2 patients dying every week. We, at one point, because we were dealing with so many people dying, we actually had a board where we would write down when somebody passed away, because it was very difficult to be able to communicate with everybody in the health center, because people knew these people for many, many years. And we're talking about people in the lab, in the front desk, the medical assistants, the people in the pharmacy, all knew these people. So it was hard to sort of get their word out. And so we had a board where people would come down, and if they wanted to, they could, and it was a right time for them, they could find out about patients that had passed away during that period of time that they hadn't looked.
In the 80s, wasn't it primarily the AIDS population was homosexual men or was intravenous drug users? And is that changed? How has that changed?
I know that there's still a very significant portion, I'd say 35 to 40% of the population are still gay men who are contracting it. And we are seeing a subset of people who are very young who are getting it, you know, in their 20s. The young people nowadays don't know people who are walking around looking cachectic and can barely breathe and are disfigured by wasting and look like something out of Auschwitz and with pock marks all over their face. We just don't see that on the streets anymore. We used to. And that was a reminder for people that this was a very devastating disease. Now, I would say that if you took 100 of my patients and lined them up and you looked at them, I would say that there's about 95% of them, you would say they look very, very healthy, just like Jerry.
I mean, what does it feel like? Do you feel like you are really a pioneer in all of this?
I definitely feel like I was a pioneer, and that we here at the Fenway were definitely pioneers at a time when this disease was a tremendous stigma. We stuck by our patients. We stayed the course. We allowed our patients to die with dignity. Many, many things have happened for the good as a result of HIV/AIDS, that we've transformed this disease process from a death sentence into a chronic disease. And I don't think I could have asked for more than that when I first started looking at this disease. I originally thought that I'm gonna stay the course, I'm going to stay at Fenway until there's a cure. And, you know, we may actually reach that time. I'm hopeful.
That's Jerry Foyer, who since the 1970s has been working as a physician assistant at the Fenway Community Health Center here in Boston. It's New England's largest provider of AIDS and HIV care. We also heard from Jerry Thorne, who's been living with AIDS for the past 10 years. They both spoke with Here Now's Deborah Becker. Well, tomorrow we continue our coverage of AIDS at 25 with journalist Phil Hiltz. How dangerous is it to say that AIDS is no longer a death sentence, and why is it still a death sentence in countries around the world? That's tomorrow. Still to come, jazz lover James Isaacs with a song that will leave you smiling. You're listening to Here and Now. Well,
Well, how much do Americans spend every year on nutritional supplements? When you add up sales from grocery stores, drug stores, nutrition shops, the internet, it comes to about $20 billion a year. But what works and what's wishful thinking? Part of the problem, points out nationally syndicated health columnist Judy Foreman, is that the law doesn't require manufacturers of these supplements to back up their claims with research, and most of these products are entirely unregulated. But Judy has a suggestion, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi.
We should say you're not bashing supplements, just trying to find a reality check. But are there supplements that can actually harm you?
Yes, some can. And, you know, the idea that if something comes from plant, it's fine is really wrong. People assume whatever says natural is safe and gentle and effective, and there's absolutely no reason to assume that.
And as you write in a recent column, some supplements can interact with other drugs.
That's right.
They have toxicity. They can affect the liver. So you have researched websites and found some that you feel give an accurate picture of the supplements. And by the way, we're going to have the information you found on our website, here-now.org. But can you tick through the sites that you found?
Sure. One of the good ones is the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, which is part of NIH, the National Institutes of Health. I like them because they're pretty simple. Like, I looked up three drugs for this column: black cohosh, which women take for menopausal symptoms; echinacea, which was really popular a while back for treating and preventing colds; and a combination of glucosamine and chondroitin for joint pain, mm-hmm. arthritis, and stuff. So I decided to see how different sites rated these three substances. The government one, NCAM, was pretty good, and you could get through it really fast. You could get kind of a bird's eye view really quickly.
Now, what do you mean by pretty good?
It seemed accurate. It seemed in line with what other sites said. And it did, one thing I really liked was it did mention this major trial called GAIT, G-A-I-T, which was a big trial of glucosamine and chondroitin. That trial was written up in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was a negative trial. It basically showed not much effectiveness except for a subset of people. Should I tell you my other favorite
Please.
Sites? The one I have to say I liked the best was by Public Citizen, Public Citizen's Health Research Group in Washington. Their site is worstpills.org. They take a really hard view. They didn't like any of these supplements that I looked at. So if you want kind of the downside view of supplements, go check that out. If you want a more encouraging thing, there are other sites.
But I can just hear supplement users saying, who backs that site?
That site, it takes no money from the government or industry, and they only get their money from membership fees.
Okay, well, tell us some others.
Slightly less clean, although I like the site, is herbalgram.org. That's put out by the American Botanical Council, which is in Texas. They do get half their money from the supplement industry. They are very, very thorough, and they do print negative information about supplements as well as positive information.
What did they say about those three?
Well, for instance,
herbs?
On black cohosh, they put out a special article in March because an Australian health agency found that it was linked to liver toxicity.
Yeah, I know you had some other sites. Why don't you tick through them?
Consumer Reports is quite a good site. They have recently added a ratings guide for natural medicines, and that group gets no industry funding, and they are only supported by subscriptions from doctors and pharmacists.
You looked at these sites through the prism of these three supplements, and they were pretty negative across the board. But did you find a supplement that they liked?
Well, it depends on which site. And it also depends, you know, on the evidence coming out. I mean, the more evidence there is, the more there's a chance for negative stuff, which is actually also true for prescription drugs.
Well, I'm on the NIH site right now here in the studio, and the news is not all negative on these sites. For instance, we've looked up garlic, and it gets a relatively high rating for reducing cholesterol. The news is mixed on some other claims about garlic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the ginkgo claims right now, and it says here on the NIH site that a lot of studies on memory and Alzheimer's treatment have had positive results. So it seems, Judy, that you can sort of find what you want to find, you know, in some of these reviews.
You know, as people get more used to looking at this stuff critically, you can see, well, what kind of a study was it? Did 5 people take this supplement for 5 days,
mm-hmm.
or did 5,000 people take it and 5,000 other people not do it? Was there really a control group? I mean, as the studies get more sophisticated, the data gets, you know, a little bit more negative.
Judy Foreman, a nationally syndicated medical columnist and our frequent guest here on Here and Now. Judy, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, all that information on our website, here-now.org. Stay with us, much more ahead here and now. It's here and now. This month, Miles Davis, universally acknowledged as one of the most relentlessly creative musicians of the 20th century, would have turned 80. In the 1940s, he was a teenage sideman with Charlie Parker. He electrified jazz with what came to be called fusion in the 60s. And before he died in 1991, Miles Davis had recorded dozens of songs that redefined improvisational music. So, what's your favorite? Here now, jazz aficionado James Isaacs joins us with his. James, welcome.
Hello, Robin.
And we're hearing what you say you might pick as one of your favorite Miles Davis performances. I mean, it would be up there with, I'm sure, many more, because how could you pick just one?
There are about, let's say, 500 candidates, individual titles over the years.
Right.
Way back in the last century, Robin, when I was an all-night jazz DJ on a small Boston station, one of my dozens of listeners called one night to ask, James, what's your single favorite, all-time favorite Miles Davis track? And I gave him this answer with very little hesitation. Someday my prince will come.
Okay, so we're going to spend some time with Someday My Prince Will Come, a wonderful way to spend some time. And let's remind people, many people already know, this was originally a song from Walt Disney's Snow White. It's the animated film. And who can forget, I can see her now, Snow, if I may call her Snow.
Quite all right with me.
Singing to the bluebirds, you know, as the dwarfs watched and swooned. Let's listen to a little bit of the original.
Someday my prince will come. Someday we'll meet again. And away to his castle we'll go.
No vibrato there.
Not too much, you know, like a truck could drive through it.
That's right. But, I mean, you just, I mean, people swooned when they heard this song. Remind us, who wrote the song?
The team of Larry Morey and Frank Churchill. They were Disney staff writers. And by the way, that voice belonged to Adriana Casalotti, who was 18 years old at the time.
Yeah. Now, this song, you would not think immediately, you know, thinking of the movie, you wouldn't immediately think jazz vehicle.
No.
So what do you think it was about Someday My Prince Will Come that attracted a jazz player?
Well, Robin, it is a sweet little song. And at the time that this was recorded by Miles Davis, 1961, jazz waltzes were becoming very fashionable, and this is one of them.
And when did it become significant for you? I mean, what was it like when you first heard it?
Well, you know, I'm 15 years old. I'm this romantic kid in the suburbs, you know, and it knocked me out. I thought it was fantastic. You know, the thing is, Robin, when music is great, it transports you, but sometimes you transport it. And again, I guess that's my very romantic 15-year-old self way of saying that this piece of music eventually did transport me, and my life at the time transported it, so that I started making these really personal connections to the soloists.
Oh, well, let's do that then. What we're going to do is we're going to deconstruct Someday My Prince Will Come as a romantic 15-year-old James heard it. Let's go through the solos one by one.
After a while, you get to learn these solos by heart, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I started to give personalities to each of the soloists in the Miles Davis Sextet of 1961. So we start with Miles. And, of course, it's well known that he was a very urbane and sophisticated guy. I thought of him as, you know, this kind of reticent suitor, you know. Now, you listen to the way that he uses space here, you know, and by space I mean the way that he uses rests in the tune. When I hear this, I think of Miles Davis saying, well, you know, I could be in love with this person. Maybe I love you, but, you know, I'm digging myself, too. And if I do manage to wake you up from your slumber, make sure you're well-dressed.
Who's up after Miles?
The middleweight champion of the tenor saxophone, Hank Mobley, and that's not my championship title term for him. It's, I think, Ira Gitler, jazz critic. When I hear Hank Mobley, I think of kind of a country guy. He's slightly shy, maybe even a little fumbling as a suitor. But he's charming. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got stuff to say, and he'd be a nice guy for Snow White to be with.
But he's got competition. Here comes the piano solo.
Oh,
who's this?
Not just any piano solo, Robin. We're talking now of one of my all-time favorites, one of the under-recognized major figures, Wynton Kelly. And he's part of the rhythm section here. Wynton Kelly, Paul Chambers, bass, Jimmy Cobb, drums. To me, Wynton Kelly, in his non-ballad style, always suggested a kid skipping home on the last day of school. When I hear this, I think of Wynton Kelly telling the sleeping Snow White, hey, wake up, we're going to have a really great time.
Okay, well, the final soloist, is coming up next.
Yeah, it's the great tenor saxophonist John Coltrane, and the year before they made this record, Coltrane had left Miles to form his own band, and he was just coming into his own as a leader when Someday My Prince Will Come was done. He'd never played this song before.
Okay.
So what does he do but unleash one of the most incredibly impassioned lyrical solos of anyone's career, not just Coltrane's.
As a suitor?
Well, he's head over heels in love. I mean, he's putting it all out there. Coltrane's been around, so he knows that, you know, maybe this isn't the wisest course of action, but, you know, it doesn't matter. He wants the world to know, and if Coltrane's sound doesn't break the spell that's been put on Snow White, well, the Queen's powers are much more evil than I thought.
I'm realizing, too, as I listen to this, that this is a whole new group of guys. You know, she had the Seven Dwarfs,
but yeah.
In this song,
right.
We have the whole, you know, each has a different personality.
Good
and
one.
And Miles brings things to an end.
Yeah, he restates the theme, and then we go out on some Wynton Kelly ascending chords. But I love the way that Miles really brings things to the end.
We've been deconstructing the legendary Miles Davis's version of Someday My Prince Will Come with here and now jazz aficionado James Isaacs. James, I'll never listen to this song the same way again. Thank you.
Well, that's what music is supposed to do for you, Robin. See you soon.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.